Welcome to the New Books Network.
Confounding, exhilarating, and contagious. Emotions matter, and so does applying emotional intelligence. Welcome to Dan Hill's EQ Spotlight, the podcast where emotions rule. Whatever the topic, how do hearts and minds collide? Find out with your host, a college professor turned globe-trotting EQ entrepreneur. His mission? Each week, Dan joins prominent authors in decoding how emotions drive outcomes and make people tick. Now, on to the show.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for joining me for the 119th episode of my podcast, Dan Hill's EQ Spotlight. The series appears here on the New Books Network, which has as its motto, sharing knowledge so people can thrive. Today's topic is men, hard facts, real solutions. I'm joined by Richard Reeves, who is the author of Boys and Men, Why the Modern Male is Struggling, Why It Matters, and What to Do About It. The publisher is Brookings Institution Press. Richard is a senior fellow in economic studies at the Brookings Institution. He's also the author of the 2017 book, Dream Hoarders, and is a regular contributor to the New York Times, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, and The Atlantic. Welcome to the show, Richard.
Thank you for having me on, Dan. Appreciate it.
Very much so. So, brief overview. What's the book about? And you even cited six main reasons why you wrote it.
Yes. Maybe I won't cover all six just to spare your listeners a little bit. But yeah, I think the main reason was just because of the really stark evidence that many of our boys and men are facing some real headwinds, some real problems. And chances are that there's a man or a boy in the lives of whoever's listening to this now that is struggling in the classroom or to find a job or how to be a father in the modern world. And those are real problems. They're not made up problems. And they're not by and large just individual problems. They are because the world has changed in ways that have become challenging for many men. So that was one reason. And the second reason was just this recognition that lots of institutions and systems have changed in ways that have become more difficult in some ways for boys and men. So we have an education system, for example, that in some ways is unfriendly to boys and men. And we can talk about that. The workplace has changed. I mean, traditionally male jobs have been particularly affected by trade and automation and so on. And then we've seen big changes in the shape of our families, which has really raised questions about what it means to be a father today and how to be a good dad. And many of those changes have ended up separating fathers from their children. And so real problems, and I think they're structural in nature. They're not just like you're failing as an individual. It's not just a question of an individual stepping up. And I think the other two reasons that I'd mention now, one is that I just see a big, colossal political failure here. I see a failure on the part of our leaders to really step up to this problem for different reasons. In some ways, they're making matters worse. I think the political left are in danger of pathologizing masculinity in some cases. But on the right, you see this sort of weaponizing of male discontent for reactionary purposes. And then the last one, you've already hinted at this, Dan, in your intro, is that as a policy wonk at the Brookings Institution, it's quite long on solutions. And I do think this is a space that's a bit short on solutions. There's lots of lamentation and hand-wringing, but not so much in terms of solutions. So I do set out some pretty big ideas for some solutions in education and in the family and in the workplace. And I hope we'll get a chance to talk a bit about those. So overall, what I've tried to do is just set out as honest and authoritative an assessment as I can of what's really going on, but then also with a positive agenda about what to do about it in a way that is pro-male, but also pro-equality.
Yeah, no, I think it's a tremendously important task, and I think you've had the courage to take it on. And there are a lot of startling facts in the book that I think make the case for why we need to pay attention to this issue. So let's delve into those and make sure we leave time to get to the solutions that you're proposing. So there's a chapter called Girls Rule, and back in the day, I taught college both at Brown University, Rutgers University, and before that at what's now Missouri State University. And I saw then already a bit of what is even more prevalent now, which is that men have a lower graduation rate. I think you actually cite 9%, which is a pretty substantial gap. Want to talk a bit more about Pink Campuses, Girls Rule? What's going on in education?
Sure. There are these glaring gaps on college campuses, as you point out. For every three women on campus now, there are only about two men. the graduation rates are of starkly different. In fact, the gender gap in getting four-year college degrees is bigger today than it was in 1972, which is when we passed legislation to help women. But it's flipped. It's the other way around. So in 1972, there was a 13-point gap in favor of men in college completion rates. And now there's a 15-point gap in favor of women. So it's just completely reversed in a way that no one really predicted. But it does, to some extent, that's a reflection of what happens earlier. All the way through the education system, you're seeing boys struggling. And so to some extent, it's just expressed in what's happening on college campuses at the end of the road. And so even high school, you see really big differences in GPA and in high school graduation rates and so on too. So there's a set of problems here, which because they're across the age range, they're almost every stage of the education system. But also here, it is important to take an international perspective. It's true in every country in the world. That college gap you just referred to, Dan, is present in every advanced economy in the world. And so this is not a peculiar or local problem. This is a much wider problem that we face in terms of like what is happening to boys and men in our education system and how can we help them? And as you say, the statistics are pretty stark. One more, just in terms of high school, is that if you look at high school GPA and you look at the 10% of kids with the highest GPA, two-thirds of them are girls. If you look at those with the lowest GPA, two-thirds of them are boys. So just at every stage, really, you do see this pretty stark gender gap, which just widens as you go through. And that obviously has implications then for what follows, work, life, family, etc.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I taught in the honors program at Rutgers, and most of my students were female. It was pretty clear from the first moment I walked in the room, and it never changed course after course. Let's move on to the workplace. Also a stunning statistic in that case, you say that for men without a high school education, one out of three of them is not in the labor force today. Basically, I had to say, wow.
Yeah, I mean, the men who are really facing the biggest challenges, and it's really important to say this, are the ones who are lower down the education spectrum, economically, and so on, and especially if they're Black. And so I think this is part of the problem with this debate, which is that if you say, well, actually, you know, there are a lot of boys and men who are struggling, if your audience is well-educated, affluent, upper-middle-class people, they look around and they go, really? And that's because they're not seeing where the problem is. The problem really is lower down. And so what you're seeing particularly is this huge drop in labor force participation among less educated men. And you're right, among the least educated, it's dramatic. And but even as you move up the education distribution, you just see like there are fewer men in work today than there used to be. You are seeing this big decline in employment among certain men. And so that, again, has huge implications. You know, so if they're not doing well in the education system, less likely to be having successful employment. That has implications for family. And so looking at this thing in the round, what you see is a lot of men who are struggling. They're dislocated by many of the changes that are around them. The education system is not working very well for them. But that means that they then enter the workforce not very well prepared. And the workforce, if you're not very well prepared, is a pretty punishing place. And in particular, what's happened is that the sort of jobs that men used to be able to do simply because they were stronger, physically stronger, they've essentially disappeared. There aren't very many jobs now. There are some, but there are fewer and fewer jobs now where just sheer physical strength is an advantage. And more jobs where interpersonal relationships, et cetera, are more of an advantage. And so that world is gone and we have failed to catch up.
Yeah, no, and it's the women who are often very good at the so-called soft skills of empathy and communication and collaboration, more so historically, or at least by stereotype, than men. I've certainly seen that in corporate life before I started my own company. So many of the managers were women. Very rarely were there as many male leaders, unless it was very operationally oriented, mechanically oriented. And so it tended to be a situation where you had executives who were still pretty overwhelmingly white male and managers who were a little more diverse. There were certainly female Black managers, but the managerial core was at least at parity, if not more dominated by women.
Yeah, that's all true. But it's also a good chance to just underline something you've just said, Dan, which is that like at the top reaches of many of our institutions, there are still a gender gap in the way we normally think about it. particularly in boardrooms and look at Congress, still only one in four women in Congress. And so there are still plenty of places where there's more to do in terms of promoting women's opportunities. It's also true that just on average, there are these differences between men and women, but they don't tell us anything about individuals. And so one of the traps that people fall into in this debate is either to say there are no intrinsic differences between men and women. Well, that's not true. But the other problem is to say, and they're so huge, they determine everything in life, right?
And can't be overcome or addressed.
Yeah, yeah. It's like, I mean, you're a professor, you understand overlapping distributions. You understand that things can be true on average, but that doesn't mean that they're true for most people and so on. So we're caught between a sort of, an unrealistic view or that there are no differences and an overdetermining of those differences. But everything else equal, you're right. That actually there is a little bit more skill for women around the people side and men have typically been more around things. So this is what psychologists call the people things distinction. And there is some truth to it, no question.
Sure. And there's another chapter I want to touch on because we've looked at education, we've looked at the workplace. Now we need to move to personal life. So many statistics here are striking in your book, but I'll cite two to kind of tee this up. One, women are now the primary breadwinner in 41% of U.S. households. Another one, 40% of births are now taking place outside of marriage in the U.S. That's up from 11% in 1970.
Yeah, I think that just underlines the transformation in family life that we've seen in a generation. I speak as a father of three grown sons. That's one of the other reasons that I wrote the book, is a little bit of personal experience of seeing boys growing up in this world. But also, my generation, I'm in my early 50s. The economic relationships between men and women for my generation are completely different to my parents' generation. Completely different. I mean, as you said, like this huge number of breadwinners now who are women. That's a transformation. I mean, it's a cultural transformation. And it's a welcome one in the sense that what it represents is a huge triumph of the women's movement to get what I would say is the main goal of the women's movement, which was economic independence for women, to make marriage a choice, to use Gloria Steinem's phrase, and to mean that women could stand on their own. And that's the message that certainly, my wife received and that all of our friends' daughters have received, and that I would absolutely communicate to any young women that I know in my life, which is make sure you have, economic power. But what that also means is a big question mark is then, okay, well, what does that mean for dads? And we haven't caught up yet. Again, it's a cultural lag problem. If we still see dads as primarily as breadwinners, and they are increasingly not fulfilling that role, or at least they're not the only ones filling that role, what does that mean? And so what that means in practice is that particularly for unmarried fathers, and you're quite right, that there's this huge rise in the number of kids being born outside marriage. And I don't really see that changing, honestly. I don't think we're going to turn back the clock on that one. Well, what does that mean for unmarried fathers? And the danger is that if really being a dad means being, bringing a paycheck, then, and as we've just discussed, a lot of men are struggling economically. The danger is that we've essentially benched the dads. And we say, look, mum can do both. Mum can raise the kids and make the money. Well, a society where we've basically benched all the dads is not a good society, especially for our sons. And so we have to reinvent fatherhood for a world of gender equality, reinvent what it means to be a dad when your partner is going to be equal, in some case, superior earning partner. But it doesn't mean that we don't need dads anymore. We need dads just as much as ever.
Absolutely. So before we pivot into the solutions part of this, one more thing I thought was very candid of you. You said you had a lot of people suggesting you not write this book, that it goes into troubled waters. And certainly you have a chapter on political stalemate. And since I've been a columnist and a pundit for Reuters and CNN and Fox and MSNBC on presidential debates and so forth, I know those waters a bit. But can you just talk a bit about that, maybe as a setup to us going into the solutions? Because you do very definitely dare to have real solutions you're proposing here.
Yes. Well, thank you for saying that, Dan. And we'll see how brave I'm actually being. I sometimes think people overstate the bravery thing. It's like, oh, look how brave I'm being, this difficult subject. And then before you know it, you're a successful YouTuber with a very profitable Substack complaining about your lack of audience. So I don't want to overstate this, but I do think it is there's no question that it's difficult water. And I think that's because for two reasons. One, it has become quite polarized politically. And I do think that particularly in the sort of, you know, air war type politics that we see, that the whole issue of gender and sex has become quite politicized. And so it really is a sort of pick your side. You know, there's either a war on women and we still live in a patriarchy and how can you even talk about boys and men? So come this way. Or there's a war on boys and men and feminism has destroyed the family and society. So come this way. And of course, most people are nowhere near either of those extremes. What most people are trying to do is raise their kids and make their lives work and make their relationships work in what are quite challenging times. And so I guess it's just a sort of a recognition that things are, that this is a sensitive subject. And it's also, the second reason is because it's personal. I mean, we're talking about very personal things here. We're talking about ourselves. We're talking about our sons. We're talking about our brothers. We're talking about our marriages. And so this is a subject that people have views on. I mean, when you tell people that you're writing a book about something, you know, you're out at a party or you're chatting to people, it's very interesting to see what kind of reaction you get. And one of my previous books that was a biography of the 19th century British philosopher John Stuart Mill. And I could see people's eyes glaze over as I talked about they're, oh, what are you working on? Oh, a book about John Stuart Mill. I could see them regretting it immediately and sort of trying to back away. But with this one, I could barely get two sentences in before people would start sharing their own stories and their own opinions, pro or con. And so this is a very, this is both a very political issue and a very personal issue. And I think that makes it a particularly treacherous area. On the other hand, also an area that's crying out for better treatment than the one we've had so far.
Well, I took a 19th century British nonfiction course, and I confess I took it because I wanted to read Ruskin and Wilde, but I really enjoyed John Stuart Mill. But I'm not going to take away from you the mantle of some courage here, because I think when we get to the question of education, for instance, you have a pretty bold suggestion, which is to delay schooling for 1 year, what sometimes might be called redshirting boys. But you got a couple more involving education as well. So let's move into the solutions part and tee up the topic of education reform.
Yeah, so you're right. There's three big proposals that I make to try and create a more male-friendly education system. I don't think it's currently very friendly to boys and men. And the first is to start boys in school a year later than girls. And the reason for that is quite simple. Boys mature later than girls. Especially in adolescence, so all the way through. But in adolescence, girls are on many important measures of brain development, almost 2 years ahead of boys, actually. And those are the sort of skills that you develop are around self-organization, the ability to stay on track, etc. This is like prefrontal cortex, CEO of the brain stuff. And it just develops earlier in girls, partly because girls have hit puberty earlier. It just does. And so for all the debates about sex differences in adults, the really big difference is the timing of development. And so what that means is that 15-year-old girls and 15-year-old boys are the same chronological age, but they're not the same developmental age. The boys are developmentally behind them. But we continue to run education as if that's not true. And essentially, the education system is structured in favor of girls in that sense, like neuroscientifically. And also the other thing I've discovered doing some reporting on this, including for a piece of The Atlantic, is that actually in private schools, it's pretty common for boys to be held back. I was told by one school counselor that there are two cutoff dates in our school, one for girls and one for boys. And the rates of redshirting, to use that term, for delayed start are pretty high for boys in private schools. And so they know something. And it's higher for more affluent, more educated parents generally. So that's a big one for me, is to just try and level the playing field a little bit by giving boys this later start. So that's number one. Number two, I'll do the other two very quickly, is more male teachers. As people are watching the news recently, we do face a bit of a teacher shortage. So let's try and solve that with the other half of the labor force. But actually teaching as a profession, K-12 teaching, is becoming more female every year. And 76% of K-12 teachers now are women, only 1 in 10 elementary school teachers. There are many elementary schools with absolutely no male teachers at all. In early years education, it's even more stark. There are actually twice as many women flying fighter planes as there are men teaching pre-K or kindergarten. as a share of the profession, I should say. So I think more male, and also it just seems like boys do better when there are more male teachers around. The evidence is, you know, it is contested, but there's pretty good evidence, particularly in subjects like English. So more male teachers for sure, especially male teachers of color, but more men generally. And then the third is more vocational training. One of the areas where actually boys and men do seem to do better and flourish is when they get the chance to do vocational learning, a bit more hands-on learning. Comes back to the thing you said earlier, Dan, about some of the sex differences. So, you know, I asked for 1,000 more technical high schools, big investments in apprenticeships and so on, and get away a little bit from the sort of narrowly academic track, because that does seem to help boys. So those are the sort of three pretty big reforms that I suggest we make to our education system.
Sure. Well, you know, in Germany, for instance, they have a lot of emphasis on VOTEC, and it's been very successful. Regarding male teachers, I see the importance. For one thing, if you don't have a dad in the house, not to have a male role model that when you then go to school, seems just repeating the deficit or deepening it. Finally, on the red shirting, just by chance, my family lived in Italy for 2 years when I was a boy, and I was held back when I got back because, having gone to Italian first grade in a fishing village where I didn't know the language, meant I didn't come back with a whole lot of knowledge. And being held back a year, I guess in my case, seemed to have worked out. Let's move to the economy. So STEM is well known, but you're suggesting a new acronym, HEAL. So what does the L for literacy particularly entail is one question I might have, but just more broadly, what's the significance of emphasizing HEAL?
Yes, so HEAL is the way to think about HEAL is almost as the mirror image of STEM, which is obviously science, technology, engineering, and math. And so HEAL stands for health, education, administration, and literacy. And just like STEM, it captures both some actual subjects, some specific subjects, but also some skills. So the M in STEM for math isn't just because we need more mathematicians. There are very few mathematicians in the labor market. What it's really saying is we need more people with math skills. There are lots of jobs that require those sorts of skills. And we need more girls and women in those professions. And we've actually made some big strides in terms of getting more women to STEM. We're not there yet by any means, but it's not nothing that most scientists in the US now are women. That's a significant achievement. And the number of women engineers has increased fivefold in the last 20, 30 years, and not by accident, but as a result of serious campaigning. So I see the literacy part of this is really just like a certain set of skills, communication skills, use of words, and so on. And so if you think about HEAL, health, education, administration, literacy, that includes huge professions like nursing, as well as medicine, of course, but also a teaching, those sorts of service sector jobs we've talked about, and the jobs that really require communication skills and interpersonal skills to some extent. A lot of jobs are coming in those sectors now, and they are very, very skewed towards women. We've already talked about teaching, but nursing, similarly, a lot of the service sector jobs. And so what I call for is a $1 billion investment in getting more boys and men into these HEAL sectors through subsidies, scholarships, mentoring programs, college degrees specifically aimed at them, etc. And so we've had this huge concerted national effort to get more women into STEM, which, as I said, has been very successful, still some work to be done. But we need the equivalent, because the desegregation by gender of the labor market has only happened in one direction, really. We've seen women really going into what were previously male-dominated professions, including very high-end ones like law and medicine, but very little travel the other way. And that's a problem, because that means that the jobs of the future are ones that are not currently seen as ones that are very often done by men. And so men can HEAL, and we need to get more men in those HEAL jobs, train them, subsidize them, scholarships, etc., so that they can embrace some of those jobs of the future. It's no good hankering after a lost industrial past where men could do well through brawn rather than brains. Instead, we need to help men adjust to the new labor market. And some of those jobs like nursing, there's no particular reason at all why this should be dominated by women. They didn't used to be. It was Florence Nightingale's fault that they became dominated by women. But that's a whole other podcast.
Sure. Well, and the opportunity is vast here. As you mentioned, STEM is about 9% of the U.S. economy, but the HEAL things that could be incorporated is double that, 23%, more than double that. So it's a very healthy opportunity to create opportunities and rectify some shortcomings in terms of what men are facing in the workplace. So Good stuff. So one more. We haven't really touched base on the personal front, marriages, lives, paid leave for dads is something I remember from the book. Anything more you want to talk about on that front?
Yeah, just really that I think we need to underline the importance of fatherhood, period. Not fathers as breadwinners or fathers as something else, but just fathers as fathers. Fathers matter, period. And if we don't have that message and we don't build that into our policies, otherwise the danger is that dads feel like if they're not meeting the traditional metric for successful fatherhood, they're not needed. And so you end up with a situation where 1 in 5 fathers aren't living with their kids. When parents separate, especially if they're not married, a huge number of fathers lose contact or regular contact with their kids. And I think that's because this cultural message is, well, you know, you're not doing the traditional dad thing. But it turns out that dads matter just as dads, especially to adolescents, actually. I was very struck by the evidence that dads matter for adolescents. And how do we send that message that dads matter? Well, a number of ways, but one is to make sure that, particularly for unmarried parents, that dads have rights. As things stand, if you're unmarried, in every US state, the default is full custody to the mom. And the father has to go to court to get access to his kids. And that's just, yeah, it's different if you're married, but we have a system that's built for the yesteryear, and we have to update it. But also, perhaps most strongly, I think if we're going to have paid leave policy, which we should, we're the only advanced economy that doesn't have national level paid leave policies, it should be on equal basis between men and women. I go quite radical here, Dan, and say 6 months paid leave for both mothers and fathers each, but completely independent, completely separate. And so what that means is what we're sending there is a message that dads can take time off their kids, actually, regardless of how old the kids are. In many cases, I think dads might want to do it when their kids are a bit older. But we don't want to send a message through public policy that moms matter more than dads, because dads matter at least as much as moms. And particularly in this new world of much greater economic equality, it's very important that we underpin fatherhood as an independent social institution. The sort of soundbite line that my conservative friends don't like from the book is that we need to free fatherhood from marriage. And what I mean by that is it needs to be an independent social institution. And so anybody who is a dad that's listening or has a dad, like, just, it's incredibly important not to treat dads as somehow second class parents. They are not.
No, I think that's strong, good stuff. Maybe a last question. So when you look at the landscape, everything from any possible corporate initiatives to nonprofits, foundations, the government, what, if anything, is picking up on this need and this possible agenda in any shape to give us some thrust forward?
Well, I don't see much to cheer on the political front right now. Honestly, what I see on the right is an attempt to exploit some of these real concerns that men have. Senator Josh Hawley has a book coming out on men next year, and I think I've got a pretty good sense of what that will contain, which is it's the feminist fault. Each time back the clock, there's a reactionary reflex there. So I don't see much there. But on the left, I mean, the Democrats, you know, I see a gender equality strategy coming out of the White House that makes simply no mention of any gender inequalities that run the other way. It simply doesn't mention them. So it's a completely one-sided view. And really, so, you know, the harsh thing to say is that the left are turning their back on boys and men, and the right want to turn back the clock on girls and women. And nobody in the real world thinks either of those are positive solutions. I think there's a bit more movement, though, like on the ground. I see fathers are getting more involved with their kids. We are seeing women making strides in the workplace, as we've discussed. And you're starting to see companies, especially post-pandemic, starting to realize that they do need to give their workers more flexibility, that many of them are starting to give more paid leave, especially right now. It's the more elite organizations, for sure. But I hope some of that will trickle down. So we're starting to see this recognition in workplaces that dads really matter. And I think that's an important, and yeah, that's a step forward. But I honestly think we need a bit of a cultural revolution here. I mean, the women's movement was a cultural revolution. We need a completing revolution, if you like, which is to recenter the role of boys and men in the family on new and more egalitarian terms, to help boys and men adjust to the new labor market, and to recognize when they're in trouble, as they are in the education system, and try and fix them. You know, we can think two thoughts at once. There's more to do for girls and women, but we've also got a whole heck of a lot of things now to do for boys and men. And most people in the real world both know that, and as parents, we're all trying to do that. It's just that our public policy is lagging, and I'm hoping that some of our business leaders can set the pace here, because the problems of boys and men are not going away. And if they're not addressed responsibly, then I think we are allowing those problems to fester in ways that will be bad for everybody.
Well, very admirably stated, and an important good cause. So I want to thank you, Richard. This has been episode 119, Men, Hard Facts, Real Solutions. My guest, Richard Reeves, he is the author of Boys and Men, Why the Modern Male is Struggling, Why it Matters, and What to Do About It. If you've enjoyed today's show, of course, please give it a rating or review on iTunes. Finally, I like to conclude every episode with an epigram. In this case, I took one from someone I don't even know anything about named Douglas Wilson, but his statement interested me. He said, "If boys don't learn, men won't know." Until next time, take care and be well.